Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello once again, and welcome to the program that helps you learn and improve your American English. We come to you every day with interesting stories from around the world. And we always present these stories in a way that is easy to understand if English is not your first language. Today we will begin with a story from the transit system of New York City. We will introduce you to two young people who believe they are being treated unfairly by a controversial decision the city made. Then, transportation news of another type. Have you heard about the airplane that is being flown around the world without using any fuel? Stay with us and listen and learn with VOA. Pete Musto gets us started with news from the city known as the Big Apple.
Many visitors to New York City have used the Metropolitan Transit Authority. The MTA is New York's public transportation system and one of the largest in the world. Two young Muslim comedians have brought a case against the transit system to federal court. The comedians want to advertise their new film on subway trains. The MTA had accepted anti-Muslim advertising up until last year. Now, it is blocking pro-Muslim advertising. The comedians say that a ban of their ads violates their rights under the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. The First Amendment protects many rights, including freedom of speech. At issue in the court case is the latest advertising for a movie called Beware, the Muslims Are Coming. The film is the work of a production company called Vaguely Qualified Productions. The company is taking legal action against the Metropolitan Transit Authority for failing to honor a signed contract. Under the agreement, the MTA promised to accept advertising for the film on its subway system. The two comedians, Negin Farsad and Dean Obaidallah, have already spent almost $20,000 on advertising. The MTA is now refusing the ads because it says they contain disputed political content. Glenn Caton is the legal director for Muslim Advocates, a legal rights and educational organization. He says the MTA's decision is wrong.
You can't dispute comedy. You can't dispute the underlying message, which is Muslims are human beings, some of whom have a sense of humor. Like, these are things that I don't think anyone could reasonably dispute. And that's why we think the MTA got the decision so wrong.
The MTA was involved in a similar lawsuit earlier. A group called the American Freedom Defense Initiative provides support to anti-Islamic activists and their ideas. In April, a federal court ruled in a case involving the AFDI and the MTA. The AFDI wanted the transit system to accept ads critical of Islam. The court ordered the MTA to accept the advertising. After the court's decision, the MTA decided to stop accepting ads that have sometimes been called political messaging. Gene Rushanoff is an attorney for the Strap Hangers Campaign, a group that works in support of public transit riders. He says the MTA's decision to stop accepting political messaging is strange and pointless. He says that free speech is important in New York's subway system. The subways are where people go to communicate, he adds. Beware, the Muslims are coming, is now playing on video streaming websites, such as Amazon and iTunes. But Ms. Nagin and Mr. Obaidallah say the advertising campaign was important to them. They feel that the MTA betrayed them with its decision.
What's political about saying, you know, Muslims like frittatas, or have great frittata recipes, or other posters are like, Muslims hate a bunch of things, including hipsters who wear winter hats in the summertime. There's nothing political about us just expressing who we are and telling our story. That's really the point about this.
The First Amendment is totally awesome. It protects speech, all kinds of speech, and even speech that we don't like, and that's what makes it great.
The efforts of the two filmmakers could open the way for their comedic opinions. But they could open the way for people with very different opinions, too. I'm Pete Musto.
You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. A plane that uses only solar power landed on the island of Oahu, Hawaii last week after being flown across the Pacific Ocean. The flight was the most dangerous part of the plane's planned 35,000-kilometer trip around the world. The trip is being made without using any fuel. Christopher Jones Cruz reports.
The name of the plane is Solar Impulse 2. Pilot Andre Borschberg now holds the record for the longest non-stop solo flight in history. American adventurer Steve Fawcett held the previous record after he flew around the world in 76 hours. Mr. Borschberg's trip lasted 120 hours.
Well, there he goes. The cockpit door is open.
Bravo.
First person to say hello is, of course, Bertrand Piccard, who had this idea back in 1999.
During the trip, Mr. Borschberg slept in the cockpit of the plane for regular periods of 20 minutes. During those periods, the airplane used autopilot. The flight began in Nagoya, Japan, early last week, after a month-long stop. The stop was not part of the trip's original plan. During the plane's trip from Nanjing, China, to Hawaii at the beginning of June, bad weather forced it to land in Nagoya. Swiss adventurer Bertrand Piccard will fly the airplane on the next part of the trip, from Hawaii to the Western American state of Arizona. The plane is then to be flown to New York and across the Atlantic Ocean to Europe. From there, it will fly to its final destination, Abu Dhabi, in the United Arab Emirates. Mr. Borschberg and Mr. Piccard designed the Solar Impulse 2. They say they are not trying to completely change the aviation industry. They said they are only trying to show what can be done. In a statement, Mr. Piccard said, "Can you imagine that a solar-powered airplane without fuel can now fly longer than a jet plane? This is a clear message that clean technologies can achieve impossible goals." The plane is made from carbon fiber material. The plane's wingspan is 72 meters. That is longer than the wingspan of a Boeing 747 plane. It has just one seat and weighs about as much as an automobile. The plane's wings have 17,000 solar cells that gather energy from the sun and charge the plane's batteries. The airplane has stopped in many places, including Oman, India, Myanmar, and China. If the weather conditions are good, the plane will make up to 3 stops in the United States. It will then cross the Atlantic Ocean, stopping in southern Europe and North Africa. In late July or early August, the plane will land in Abu Dhabi, where the trip began in early March. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
You are listening to the Voice of America. The program is called As It Is.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. More than 100 million people in Nigeria are not connected to the Internet. There are only a few networks that offer service, and it is costly and undependable. Now, a new project provides a resource for offline viewing at no cost. A nonprofit organization called the Wider Net Project has developed the offline eGranary digital library. The service puts millions of digital documents, multimedia work, and websites onto a server. The information is then available to students, medical workers, and researchers at no cost, whether there is internet or not. Users can access informative websites that eGranary updates every day. Other resources on the service include university and medical publications, computer software, and educational games. Ahmadu Bello University is the largest university in Nigeria and the second largest in Africa. The university uses eGranary's digital educational resources. Kasa Mathias is head of the school's database department. He says students can access tens of thousands of educational materials without much problem.
We give them the background information on the available databases that they can use for their research work, their assignments, especially projects.
Ibetoye Idowu is a first-year student of archaeology. He says easy access to university reading material, documents, and journals has greatly helped his studying process. He says that in some cases, he understands the digital materials better than class lectures. Students now have great reading material, but only when there is electric power. It often fails. Student Ibetoye Idowu says those moments are difficult.
The only challenge I'm having here is the power supply. Sometimes it will just go off.
Muhammad Muazu leads the Electrical and Computer Engineering Department. Professor Muazu says the university has spent a large amount of money on access to information. He says now it is available for 40,000 students and teachers.
With or without internet access, students and staff have access to most of these educational databases. University has also invested a lot in even internet access.
The offline digital library began in 2001. Hundreds of schools, clinics, and universities are connected to it in Africa, Southeast Asia, and many other places. WiderNet says it aims to expand to thousands more education and health centers around the world. For VOA Learning English, this has been the Education Report. I'm Jill Robbins.
We'll
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. This week in our series, we continue the story of America's 42nd president, Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton took office in January of 1993. During his 8 years as president, he appointed more women and minorities to the government than any president before him. He also appointed the second woman ever to serve on the Supreme Court. For the first 2 years of his presidency, Bill Clinton had a Congress controlled by members of his own party, the Democrats. Still, he failed in his efforts to pass legislation to reform the nation's health care system. During the presidential campaign, Bill Clinton had promised to help millions of Americans get health care coverage.
This health care system of ours is badly broken, and it is time to fix it. Despite the dedication of literally millions of talented health care professionals, our health care is too uncertain and too expensive, too bureaucratic and too wasteful. It has too much fraud and too much greed. We must make this our most urgent priority, giving every American health security, health care that can never be taken away, health care that is always there.
He appointed his wife, First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton, to lead a committee to develop the plan. Critics argued that the plan would lead to socialized medicine. In the end, lawmakers decided that the plan would cost too much and would be too difficult to administer. But President Clinton found support on other issues, including crime-fighting legislation. The measure included money for hiring more police officers and building more prisons. Congress also passed his budgets for 1993 and 94 that reduced federal spending. But Clinton's relations with Congress became more difficult after the 1994 congressional elections. The fight over health care and other issues had only led to greater dissatisfaction with Washington. The elections were a big defeat for the Democrats in Congress.
A rising tide lifts all boats, or so they say, and the Republicans are sailing right to victory in the House of Representatives, CNN estimating that the Republicans will take more than enough seats to take control of the House of Representatives for the first time in 40 years. And here's what's interesting. It is cutting across all regions. It is cutting across all ages. It is cutting across literally all the candidates.
CNN reporter Frank Sesno. Voters gave Republicans control of both the Senate and the House of Representatives for the first time in 40 years. President Clinton supported welfare reform to reduce spending on public assistance, but he blocked Republican efforts to cut what he believed was too much money from programs including health care for retirees and the poor. Budget fights with the Republican-led Congress resulted in two shutdowns of government operations.
The government is partially shutting down because Congress has failed to pass the straightforward legislation necessary to keep the government running without imposing sharp hikes in Medicare premiums and deep cuts in education and the environment. It is particularly unfortunate that the Republican Congress has brought us to this juncture because, after all, we share a central goal, balancing the federal budget. We must lift the burden of debt that threatens the future of our children and grandchildren. Unfortunately, Republican leaders in Washington have put ideology ahead of common sense and shared values.
The economy had suffered a recession during the previous administration of George H.W. Bush. After Bill Clinton became president, the economy grew slowly at first, but then recovered more quickly. 1 month into his presidency, Bill Clinton had to deal with a terrorist attack against the United States.
There's been an explosion deep below the 110-story towers of the World Trade Center in New York City.
On February 26, 1993, members of Al-Qaeda attacked the World Trade Center in New York City. The terrorists left a truck loaded with explosives in an underground parking garage.
By early afternoon, Lower Manhattan looked like a war zone. Office workers, faces blackened with smoke and soot, hundreds gasping for breath, staggered into the frigid February air.
The attack killed six people and injured more than 1,000 others. The government later captured those responsible for the bombing. On April 19, 1995, terrorists again struck the United States. Only this time, it was a case of homegrown terrorism. The target was the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma.
It was an explosion blowing off the entire north face of that building.
The bombing killed 168 people. It was the deadliest terrorist attack ever on American soil up to that time. The man behind the attack was Timothy McVeigh, a former soldier who hated the government. He was captured soon after the explosion. McVeigh was tried and in 2001 executed for his crimes. A friend of his, another military veteran, was also involved in the plot and was sent to prison. President Clinton also had to deal with foreign and humanitarian crises.
A year ago, we all watched with horror as Somali children and their families lay dying by the tens of thousands, dying the slow, agonizing death of starvation. A starvation brought on not only by drought, but also by the anarchy that then prevailed in that country.
President Bush had sent American troops to Somalia in 1992 to assist the United Nations in feeding starving Somalis. Civil war was preventing the people from receiving aid during a drought. In October of 1993, 18 American soldiers were killed in a battle in Mogadishu. It happened during a failed raid on a hotel to search for a militia leader.
This past weekend, we all reacted with anger and horror as an armed Somali gang desecrated the bodies of our American soldiers and displayed a captured American pilot, all of them soldiers who were taking part in an international effort to end the starvation of the Somali people themselves. These tragic events raise hard questions about our effort in Somalia. Why are we still there? What are we trying to accomplish? How did a humanitarian mission turn violent? And when will our people come home? These questions deserve straight answers. Let's start by remembering why our troops went into Somalia in the first place. We went because only the United States could help stop one of the great human tragedies of this time. A third of a million people had died of starvation and disease. Twice that many more were at risk of dying. Meanwhile, tons of relief supplies piled up in the capital of Mogadishu because a small number of Somalis stopped food from reaching their own countrymen. Our troops created a secure environment so that food and medicine could get through. We saved close to 1 million lives. And throughout most of Somalia, life began returning to normal. Nearly a million Somalis still depend completely on relief supplies, but at least the starvation is gone. And none of this would have happened without American leadership and America's troops. Let us demonstrate to the world, as generations of Americans have done before us, that when Americans take on a challenge, they do their job right.
But members of Congress demanded a withdrawal. A few days after the battle, President Clinton ordered American troops to leave Somalia within 6 months. In 1994, President Clinton sent troops to Haiti to return that country's first democratically elected leader to office. Military officers had overthrown President Jean-Bertrand Aristide 3 years earlier. That crisis led thousands of Haitian refugees to try to flee to the United States by boat. In 1995, American diplomatic efforts, as well as NATO airstrikes, helped produce a peace agreement to end the long and bloody civil war in Bosnia. President Clinton sent American peacekeeping troops to the former Yugoslav Republic. In November of 1993, Congress approved NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. The agreement ended most import taxes between the United States, Canada, and Mexico. It lowered barriers to the flow of goods, services, and investments. President Bush had signed the agreement with Mexico and Canada. American labor unions and environmental groups opposed NAFTA, but Congress approved it, and President Clinton signed it into law. Personal issues from Bill Clinton's past in Arkansas became part of his future as President of the United States. In the late 1970s, he and Hillary Clinton had invested in a land development company in Arkansas called Whitewater. Others involved with Whitewater were in legal trouble by the time Bill Clinton, a former governor of Arkansas, became president. A former judge who owned a savings and loan bank accused Clinton of pressuring him to make illegal loans to help the company. Clinton denied that. And there were questions and accusations about Hillary Clinton from the years when she worked as a lawyer in Little Rock, Arkansas. In January of 1994, after a year as president, Bill Clinton asked Attorney General Janet Reno to appoint an independent investigator. The Attorney General named a Republican, Robert Fisk, to look into the activities of the Clintons. But critics accused him of being too friendly to the administration. In August, three federal judges replaced him with another Republican lawyer, Kenneth Starr. Public opinion was divided about the situation. Some people thought the president and his wife were corrupt. Others thought any accusations of wrongdoing were nothing more than political attacks. Bill Clinton went on to win a second term in the elections in November of 1996. But new issues about his personal behavior would lead Republicans to try to remove him from office. Clinton's second term will be our story next week. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English.